You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Suzanne Jabor. Suzanne describes herself as a grieving mom. She's experienced what a lot of parents might describe as their worst nightmare, which is the death of a child. So when I was naming this program, the show, The Art of Imperfect Adulting, and beginning to talk to people about it, I actually got a lot of pushback about choosing to use the word adult. And people would come to me and they would say, well, do you actually mean parent? Shouldn't you just say parent? And I would actually answer, I would say no, because I don't actually just mean parent. Being a parent and being a step parent, those happen to be a big part of my adulting experience, but it's not the only thing. I was an adult before I was a step parent. I was an adult before I was a parent. And it's my belief that the skills of being an adult, they overlap some of the experiences of being a parent, but they're not exclusive. And to shut that out into just one or the other wasn't what I wanted to do. So I mention this because if you think that when I describe this as a grieving mom and you're thinking to yourself, you know what, I'm not sure if the story of parental grief applies to me, I just invite you to be curious about it. Just be curious about whether or not that might really be true. So Suzanne shares her own story of grief, healing, and transformation. And while the meat of our conversation is about exploring what it means to face grief head on, we also find ourselves chatting about walking in nature. I learned in this interview that there are so many more seasons of Survivor than I had any idea. And it turns out that neither of us is in a rush to book a ticket to Mars. So, are you ready? I'm ready. Let's do this. Suzanne Jabor, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I am ready for a fun chat.
Yay, let's do it. All right. I start every interview by asking people where they call home. Where are you these days?
I am in Vancouver, Canada, so British Columbia, just north of Seattle. So if you're in the U.S. and you know anything about Seattle, it's exactly that, except Canada.
Exactly. So I have done several interviews of people who are in the Seattle, Vancouver area. And the thing I always mention is I do believe that it is the longest flight and longest nonstop flight is Miami, where I live, to Seattle.
Oh, I bet it is.
Yeah. So and it's a flight worthy of getting the nonstop, because if you break it up, forget about it. That's a long day. All right. So in a second, we're going to start the official topic of the interview. But before we do, I want to ask one more get to know you question, which is share with us, me and the audience, something about you that is a hobby, a passion, something you love, but it's not work or family related.
That's such a hard question, because most of my hobbies I do with family. So I actually had to think of one that like no one in my family does with me. And so I would say for me, that hobby that keeps me going is being in nature. So going for walks down to I live quite close to the beach. I'm very, very lucky. So it's a 10-minute walk down to the beach where there is not really surf, but there's water. Or I can get very quickly into a forest. So for me, that's the thing. Get me into some nature.
That's wonderful. That is wonderful. I love that. So walking by the beach, hiking in the forest, all of that. That's a fantastic passion. Okay. So we're going to get to the topic of the day, which is rebuilding your life after the death of your adult son. I know you've talked a lot about this, and it's a thing you're comfortable with, but are you ready to have one more conversation with me about this?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think that, first of all, I love that you were like, let's have a fun conversation. And I'm like, all in. Because it doesn't need to be a heavy conversation. So for people that are already like, ooh, fast forward, don't want to talk about this, it really is not going to be a heavy, hard conversation. And I am always ready to have a conversation about it, because if we were having more conversations about it, about grief and loss and rebuilding, we would be much better adulting.
Yeah, it is a part of the human experience. And it's one of those things that most of us, we don't have the life experience to really be good at it. And be trained in it. And it falls into the list. I have a list of things that we do a terrible job of preparing each other for. Like I said, we do a terrible job of preparing our kids for some of these things. That's not always true. There are going to be families that have a lot of experience in this, but we do sort of segment it. So before we dig into the details of the intense story, I want to paint a little bit of a picture of your life before this happened so that we know. So I think you led into this. Was this an only child, or are there other kids in your family? Tell me more about your family and what life was like before this happened.
Yeah, I have a daughter as well. And so Ben died in September of 2020. So if you can cast your mind back to that fun time on the farm,
Yeah.
it was, as my daughter says, chaos and shenanigans, globally chaos and shenanigans, right? The world was literally on fire. We're all locked down, various degrees of lockdown on and off for COVID, as we tried to navigate that as a collective. There's all kinds of civil unrest because of the George Floyd murder. All kinds of things were happening. It's a very complicated time on the planet. So my daughter actually had 8 years before that or so moved to Toronto, which is sort of eastern from here, as everything is, to go to school, and then was building her career there. She was one of the many, many COVID come home kids, as I call them, because as airlines started to cancel flights and we started to see that really this was actually, we were going to have to shelter in place, I wanted her here. So she had moved back in with Ben and I. And, with her one suitcase with like, we're so naive, right? Just bring a couple pairs of leggings and like some t-shirts and your PJs. Like, you're only going to be here a couple weeks. Yeah, she's still here. needless to say, we have gone back and got all her stuff. But that was kind of life at that time. We really were so happy to have her back because, she was settled somewhere 3,000 miles away. And we were just all doing the best we knew how to try and navigate this strange thing that was happening to all of us. It's, I think for me, I'm in my mid-50s, and it was the first time in my lifetime we'd had that kind of collective global experience. Like, I wasn't around for any of the world wars. So we had, or, the Great Depression or the plague, or, there's all these kind of times where we had these collective planet human ex experiences. And that for me was kind of the first one. So that was really hard to navigate.
Yeah, it is a, it was a, it definitely lockdown was a collective experience for so many people. And there are others that have happened in our lifetime, but they're flashes. Like we can ask
Yes.
people. So like you and I are a similar age. So I could ask you, where were you when the Challenger shuttle exploded? Right.
Yeah.
That's one of our generation. People who are older than us, you and I are too young to do this, would ask each other, where were you when John F. Kennedy was assassinated? Like those are flashes in time, but such
Yeah.
an
But there are also
extended.
things that specifically happened in the US.
True. Well, that is a very US-centered. I'm sure there are other international ones. We could do Where
Yeah.
Were You When the Wall? My earliest news memory that I remember is the Berlin Wall falling.
Yes. Yeah,
So,
100%.
like, I remember seeing that on the news.
Yeah.
But yeah, like those, I did give absolutely US-centered answers,
Yeah.
which
And
is,
ones that impact us. Like, I remember when the Challenger exploded. I remember watching it. I remember that when the Twin Towers happened. So there are those kind of flash moments, but not something that was kind of sustained and where we had to really lean into helping each other and figuring out like how are we going to do this like in a way.
It's so interesting. I love that you called it the COVID come home because, so I live in Florida, which and we didn't do as much of the lockdown as many other places did. We had a different thing, which is we invited everybody to come and hang out with us in Florida. So we did, but it was everybody came. Like I had a very full house. Everybody was in my life. Everything was around. I was like, okay, it's time for you guys to go. I need some
Please go
space.
home.
Please go home. When are you leaving? So yeah, the love you go,
Yeah.
and
I
that
love
was
you
not an
really a
option.
lot when you're not in my house. Yeah.
That was totally not an option. All right. So let's talk a little bit about exposure to grief and death before you went through this very personal experience.
Yeah.
Had you had other experiences with death of family members or friends, and did you know anybody who had actually gone through the process of losing a child?
So yes, I want to preface what I'm going to say by saying we are very ill-equipped. Our language is not rich when it comes to talking about grief. So when I say that I'm really grateful I had had close losses before Ben died, it's not that I'm grateful people died. It's that I'm grateful I had had that experience. So I had some skills in my toolbox, not enough of them at all. But yes, my dad died when I was in my early 30s. So far too young. And my mom died when I was in my mid-40s.
Okay, so you had
So
definitely
I had
been.
actually experienced the
Yes.
loss of both of my parents before Ben died. And yet I was wholly unprepared for the death of a child. There's
Yeah.
something about that out of order death that is next level. And I think also because Ben still lived with me, you know, he was still very, I think it's similar with spouses. I see a lot of parallels with people who've lost spouses. It's the people who are that intrinsically embedded in our day-to-day life.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I see
So
that.
you're
Yeah.
losing like the person you come home and debrief with. You're losing the person who, you know, is in your way, that leaves their stuff in the kitchen, that makes a mess in the bathroom.
Yes.
But also, like the person who took out the garbage, the person who did some of the groceries, like it's those intrinsic, like embedded things that I also think makes the loss different.
I can absolutely see that. So I have not experienced the loss of a child or but I did, my dad died when I was in my mid 30s. So that's the closest person. And the reason I asked about your experience was that when I went through that, I had an impression as I was navigating it that I did not know anybody who had gone through a similar experience. It
Yes.
turned out actually that that was wrong. Like it was that I knew tons of people who had experienced it because it is a human experience. I just was looking in the wrong places. But that was my experience. And the things that were so interruptory, which is not a word, but all of the patterns and all of the habits, like the regular conversations and the holidays and the reminders. And if you are living with somebody, that would be almost every moment of every day. So
Yeah.
that would be a much more intense process. All right. So you did have some experience, which I think that learning how to talk about it, having experience, even watching other people, I think that, you know, it's two sides of the same coin. It's like one, it's preparing you, and the other, you can't actually prepare for things you haven't gone through. So, that's, you want to, but it's hard. All right. So do you want to share with us and the audience the story of some of the details of how your son passed away so that we know what we're talking about?
Yeah, so I, you know, literally lived every parent's worst nightmare. My daughter and I had gone away for the weekend, and Ben decided not to come with us, which was fine. It was the, you know, that was fine. He'd been away with friends the week before, and really, I think, was, you know, thrilled to have the apartment to himself because there's three of us living in our apartment that was for two people. And I got a middle of the night phone call, literally, got that middle of the night phone call that parents dread from the police. Telling me that he had died. And that was as surreal, discombobulating, disorienting, confusing. Like, you know, we're such sense-making creatures that we immediately go to trying to make sense of things. And in grief, especially, we're trying to make sense of the nonsensical. Because it's never going to make sense. I mean, ultimately, over time and work, it does make sense. But in the immediate aftermath of getting the news or the person dying, we struggle a lot with making sense of it. Ben died of depression and anxiety,
Okay.
and many people would say he died by suicide, which is also the truth. I choose to say he died of depression and anxiety because I find it endlessly frustrating that we don't treat mental illness the same way we treat physical illness.
It is a puzzler. It is
It's, I mean,
absolutely a
it's really
puzzler.
not a
It
puzzler. There's all kinds of reasons why that is, and all kinds of, you know, ways that I can make sense of why we do that and why we're
Yeah.
stuck. And it's not okay with me. So
I
that's why I
do
choose to
find it.
say.
I have, like, I mean, it's one of those things that I accepted when I was younger because it's just the way it is. But now, as I get experience, I find it endlessly frustrating the things that we segment out as like this is a different part of healthcare. So, you know, I can't remove my teeth from my mouth. So why do I need separate dental insurance to cover my dental
Yeah.
coverage, right? Same with my eyeballs.
With the
Last time I,
glasses.
right, you know, hearing aids, why is this separate, right? And the last time I checked, like we talk about this, like the mind body connection, I can't separate those two. So somebody, you know, like, you know, your lungs, they're inside and you go to the pulmonologist, but it's connected. It's all part of the system. But when we go to the brain, it's super weird because neurosurgery would be part of the Western medical system.
Yes.
But like your thoughts, oh, yeah, sorry, that's a whole other game, you
Yeah.
know.
And completely siloed off.
Yes,
Like
completely
siloed
siloed off
completely
with
off
it,
from like
completely
what's
off.
physical.
Yeah, and one hand doesn't talk to the other. Rules of, and then there's the other thing. Like if you're a woman, you're like, oh, you've got your own doctor team, and like the whole. I do think that when you back up and you look at it, you're like, well, why would that be? Like, why would that be? And I remember, so we have many, many issues with health insurance in the United States, which my Canadian friends do a much better job with, but. They passed, they were like, you don't need, it was like, you're going to make hearing aids more accessible so you don't have to go through like a specialist. And I remember thinking about it, I was like, why wouldn't this be available just to anybody? Like, why would you need to jump through hoops? Like, it's like, it should be, do we want people to not be able to hear? Like, what's the problem here? Anyway, I have opinions, obviously. Good thing I'm not in charge. All right. So anytime I talk to somebody about, a family member that's been sick or that has passed away, I like to take a second and flip it around a little bit. And because we're talking about the end of this person's life and the impact it had on you, but I do want to take a second and celebrate the person in their life because people are more than the story of their illness and their death. So, do you want to share with us something, a memory or something that was wonderful about Ben, as a memory of who he was as a living person?
Yeah, and I love that question. Thank you so much. For those of you that are listening that are supporters, please know we want to talk about our person. You will not make us sadder or make it worse by asking us about our person or sharing something if you knew them that you're remembering about them. That is a gift to us. So, yes, thank you. This is a beautiful question. Oh, there's just so many things. Ben was a magical unicorn, of course, because I'm his mother, and so I think so. What I learned so much from him, which are the things that I kind of look back and think, and look in the present and think, there's so many things that he was passionate about that I learned to be passionate about, or at least to try to understand why you would be passionate about them because of him. He loved fashion and art and architecture. He introduced me to opera.
Oh, nice.
He was just very, he was highly gifted, so super, super smart, and also the gifted brain works in a different way. So, getting to live life through the eyes of someone who sees things in a completely different way than someone like me, like I'm a pretty smart, typical kind of person,
Yeah.
but the gifted brain works a different way, and the way that it integrates information is different. So, I just always really loved seeing the world through his lens, which I think as parents, we all kind of get that. When we have toddlers
Yeah.
and they're like discovering the world, and it's so fun to kind of embrace that and rediscover the world with them. And
Yes.
then that continued on because the way that he saw the world and the way that he saw how things worked or what was interesting or what was important was so different from how I saw it. And so we could just have endless conversations about what he thought versus what I thought and come to some kind of common ground or agree to disagree or whatever it was. But those conversations were always so, so interesting.
I love that memory. And it's so true about young kids and their joy of discovering things and how much
Yeah.
fun it is. And then, as somebody who has been through four rounds of kids that age, there's also that moment when you're with them where you're like, all right, I understand that this sand is endlessly fascinating, but now it's time to leave.
Yeah.
All
100%.
right, these worms are really, really cool and they need to stay in the park. Yeah.
And they're not coming home with us.
How many sticks do we need to bring home from today's walk?
One
Yeah.
was our rule. One.
Exactly. All right. So, as I mentioned, I have not experienced the loss of a child, right? What I and my experience with my grief, my closest experience with grief was with the passing of my dad. One of the things that fascinates me about this, we're talking about decisions that you made, reinventing your life after this. The 12 to 18 months after my dad passed away was so overwhelming and so like so much pressure, just the physical grief and all of the emotional things. It's a weird combination because there are a million decisions that have to be made. And I was terrible at that point at making decisions. So, I mean, I just really thought that was kind of a big problem, to be
Yes,
honest.
it's totally true. We're asking an inhuman thing of people when we want them, when they have grief brain, to make these really important permanent decisions.
Yeah.
It's terrible. The setup is terrible.
The setup is really rough. And the thing I wanted to ask you is now today you do a lot of talking about grief. Were you somebody who had an interest in grief and things like that before this, or was it something that you
No.
discovered through the process?
Yeah, I so just before Ben died, I had just finished my coaching training, and I was about to launch a completely different program that had nothing to do with grief, which of course that all fell apart, and I just shelved everything, because as you say, that first it's really about the first 2 years, but yeah, 12 to 18 months of just really not sure which way is up and how the world works, absolutely normal, and I really knew for me. Even though I had experienced the death of my dad and my mom. So I think that second death of a parent when you become an orphan is also a big deal
That's what, yeah,
that people don't
that's what people
necessarily tell us
say.
about, but it's a big deal. So I'd had both of those, but I just knew I did not know enough about what was happening to me. I didn't understand it well enough. I didn't know what which symptoms were normal. And I talk about this in my TEDx talk. It's like that sense of like, why didn't anyone tell me this was coming? Like, why aren't we having this conversation? And even the other day, I was messaging. Oh, I was talking with a client and saying, there's a physical pain. Like, your whole body hurts. Your muscles are weak. Like, even your teeth hurt. And he was like, wait, that's exactly me. I'm like, yeah, because that's normal. But nobody tells you about it. So it really was that sense of like, is what's happening to me normal? And getting some comfort from knowing that it was doesn't make it go away, but it makes it less scary.
It makes it, you're not losing your mind,
Yeah, because I
right?
really, for
Because
a
I
time,
really, yeah,
I
I've,
was scared what was happening to my brain.
yeah, no, I,
I
it's
was
very
really scared.
similar, like not different experience, but I called a therapist for advice on how to talk to my kids.
Yeah.
About it, because I had no idea what I was doing, and that person asked me. They said, "How are you?" And I just said, "I said, yeah, I really think I might be going crazy. Like I might be losing my mind." And they were like, "Tell me about it." And then they're like, "No, this is grief. This is grief." And it was an enormous weight off my chest because, just like you said, it was the very first time that I had ever actually experienced that an emotion could be so strong that it would be physically painful.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that your brain just does not work. It's like your
Right.
brain is all of a sudden made of mashed potatoes,
Yeah.
flavorless, smooth, nothing, like just
Oh,
nothing.
just nothing. Yeah.
And I also was really clear in knowing that the person who I was before that phone call no longer existed.
You really did. I mean, this is a situation that is so famously scary and emotional that it shows up in movies. Like they cinematize it because the drama is right there. You live through the thing that is the experience that that most of us will not go through, and we fear. We were talking about our phones being on Do Not Disturb before we started this interview, and I shared how my kids are the only time my phone rings is when the kids call, and my heart pounds because I am afraid of not even this, but a car accident, which I have a million children. We have been through that.
Yeah.
We have the fender bender, like it's like, that part. But no, I am
And the flip side of
deeply.
it for me is my phone is not on Do Not Disturb even overnight.
No, I can,
Because if they need to phone me, my phone needs to ring.
No, I can
Right? So
definitely see that.
it's so interesting. And I talk to people all the time and we're like, oh, how can you have your phone on in the nighttime? And I'm like, because I've received a middle of the night phone call that I would not have wanted to miss.
No,
So
100%. I can
it's
see it.
so interesting how our experiences really shape even our relationship with technology.
100%. Yeah. No. It's definitely there. And my experience with grief was that I made the phone call. Like, so
Yes.
my dad didn't call me back, so I had to call and inquire. So I didn't get the call. I made the call.
Yeah.
But getting the call and having that be on the other end, I can see how that would absolutely be a fork in the road of the future.
Yeah. And I think because I had that knowing, that meant I had to start to make decisions, little tiny ones, because I also knew my brain didn't work very well, about who I was going to be now. Like, who was
Oh,
I going to
yeah.
be next? What was important to me? And I had such a strong, and I've tried to get AI to help me make the picture, and I can't get it right. But in my head, I had such a strong image of me standing with my arms full of like those big, huge 3D puzzle pieces, like on Survivor,
Yeah.
and a whole bunch of other puzzle pieces on the ground around me. And that was me. Like I now was in these little pieces. And I had to decide which ones to pick up and take with me.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I
And
see
my
it.
arms are already full, and I can see parts of like who I am and what was important to me and what I mattered, and like it's all on the ground. And my arms are already full. And
Right.
I knew I needed to take baby steps and keep moving. Like there was still a life here to be lived that was mine and that I wanted to honor Ben and honor my daughter, and I wanted to be able to help her figure out like what does life look like. So it really was absolutely one, and I don't know that there's any way it couldn't be one of those fork in the road moments. I'm very, very grateful that I already had done so much work on myself, and I already really lived from that place of possibility, from that place of curiosity. Because if I hadn't had that as my North Star, I don't know how it would have gone.
I can definitely see that. And you touched on a couple of things there that I'll just echo back because they are really important. One of the challenges with any big experience when you are in a family is, you were doing more than one thing. You were taking care of yourself and also trying to be there for your daughter. And that's a layer of complexity that makes things harder. It also can be an escape route. You'll see people like dive into caring for other people and not themselves, right? And you talk about that you had a pretty good sense of your own identity and your North Star, right? Which I think is key because when big things happen and you are searching, it's another level of destabilization, right? Like, so your connections to who you think you are things that we can ignore. And when stuff goes wrong, if they're not there, it's harder to find our way back.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. And I got a download, whatever, however people think they have these ideas, I just call it a download very early on, that the path for me was to be conscious and curious.
Okay, yeah.
So conscious was about allowing all of the emotions to be okay, to be acceptable, even the ones from the bad negative list, the ones that were overwhelming, the ones that were all tangled, like that just had to all be okay. The stuffing that we do so well, especially in North America and Western culture, was not going to work. That was not going to be survivable. So allowing all of the emotions to flow and overwhelm and do what they needed to do. And the curiosity was really about, in the very earliest days, it's about what has to get done today.
Right. No, it's
And that's it. Like,
overwhelming. Yeah.
our rule was one hard thing, and then the rest of the day, the to-do list was to breathe.
Okay,
And
that's
that was
good.
literally the list. One hard thing. So, do I need to cancel an account? Do I need to notify somebody? One of those things, and then breathe. That was it. That's how we managed our to-do list. And the curiosity also at the very beginning literally was around physical things. Like when you're crying so hard that you can only gasp for breath, how do you oxygenate your body? Like you can't
Yeah.
do that for a long period of time because that doesn't feel survivable. So, and I was all literally about survival. It was like, how do I survive? So it really was that sense of, okay, somebody knows. Somehow I will find the answer. I will figure it out. And I did. I listened to this amazing podcast where they would talk specifically about when you're sobbing so hard, what you do. I was like, oh, I 100% need that. And I
There
just
you
did
go.
over and over to close that stress cycle. Cause I was also really new that my body was, and my mind and my mind, the whole mind, body, spirit connection was all, every level was an overwhelm.
Yeah.
And for that to not become malignant, I had to tend it very carefully.
I think that means you're more aware than I think you could have numbed it out and ignored it. I think that was a
Yeah.
choice
And
there.
I think there's healthy numbing. Watched all 42 seasons of Survivor.
There are 42 seasons of Survivor. I know that's a
I mean, I
weird
think there's
thing for me to
47 now, but at the time there was 42, and I could not be in the house when it was quiet. So when my daughter went back to work, she was working in person and I was still working from home. And I couldn't stand the house to be quiet. So I was like, well, what can I put on that requires no mental capacity that can just play in the background? And, thanks to the wonders of technology, you can sign up for a streaming service that has every season of anything you want. And that's what streamed for however long that took me. 2 months,
That
I think,
is
3 months.
outrageous. I know that's a strange thing for me to grab onto in what you said, that there are 42 seasons of Survivor, but that just seems like so many seasons.
I think there's more than that now, but at the
I
time
believe
it was
it.
like
I
42
believe
or
it.
something like
That's
that.
what a long four. That's a lot of TV, but I do get that. I think that that's an easy thing for people to understand, what you would be uncomfortable with, the quiet, and that it would be comforting to be entertained with something that didn't require. I think that many of us have been through that part of stress management, even in smaller things. Okay, so we're talking about rebuilding your life after this. Let's talk a little bit about what that means. Like, what did you feel like needed to be rebuilt?
I mean, really everything. And it was really interesting in that I rebuilt relationships. Like, relationships completely transformed. My focus on, what's important in the world and how I want to be, how much I'm prepared to overgive. I'm a recovering people pleaser. That
Sure.
all went by the wayside, like in a way that I think was shocking to a lot of people, because I had no capacity to do that anymore. I mean, it's almost 5 years now since Ben died. I have very limited capacity for like bullshit and complaining and gossip and whining. Like, and I think what happens for us when something truly catastrophic happens, our capacity to relate with people for whom catastrophic is they
Yes.
didn't have the kind of milk I wanted at the store today is severely limited.
Yeah,
Like,
so
it's
yeah.
just, and I would be, it would take everything I had. And I do still sometimes say, in the kindest way I can think of, if that's the worst thing that happens to you today, it's a pretty good day.
Yeah, no,
Like, your perspective really shifts. And my focus on what I wanted to be doing out in the world shifted. The programs that I had designed and was launching has been died. I don't know, they might come back at some point because they're still important, but it became so obviously clear to me that as a collective, we didn't know enough about grief, and we didn't know how to support people, and we didn't know what was happening to us if we were the griever. And as someone who, I mean, I've been public speaking since I was in elementary school, like, speaking was not hard for me. Writing is not hard for me. So if I could be a voice for people who don't feel comfortable talking about it, so they could say to a friend, "Hey, you want to understand what's happened to me? Go listen to this podcast. This woman talks about it." Right?
Yeah.
That it was like that really became my focus and my passion is, how can I do everything I can in my one precious life to push this conversation, to shift this paradigm, to change this system? Because it's systemic. Our lack of knowledge, our gap in care, our misunderstanding of how to reach out and support people is for most of us. And even as someone who lives and breathes this 24/7, I still am like, oh, okay, I need to say something. I need to offer something. And you still have to kind of really slow down and think about what's right in this circumstance, what's right with this person. It's different every time. For me as an individual griever, it's different every time. My grief for my dad was different than the grief for my mom, is different than my grief for Ben. And there are about 10 symptoms you probably will have at some point. And they're really, I believe, is a way we can flip how we talk to people and how we make offers that makes all the difference.
That
So
makes
that's
sense.
really become my drive.
That makes sense. And when I it is interesting, because when I was writing this and thinking about the questions that I was going to ask you, and I have the experiences with grief that I've had, which are, limited. Grandparents, my father's pets, a few friends, like things like that, but they are limited. And it definitely was front of mind for me that it is completely different than the experience you've gone through, and that not necessarily helpful or productive for me to make them seem like they're equivalent, and I know that they're not. And yet it's a space making, like, once you've experienced a catastrophic loss, I think that it makes it easier for us to give space to other people who we can see are going through that, which lines up with what you were saying. It's like you don't know what catastrophe is until you've done it. And anybody who's ever worked in an emergency type situation where you're walking somebody through that triage, it's like, listen, is this important? Is it urgent? Is it emergency, or is it a catastrophe? Is the house actually on fire, or are you just unhappy about the temperature of your meal?
Yeah. And I think we do that with our kids. I mean, I remember with my kids, we had a sort of structure that we would go through. I would be like, okay, so are you going to care about that in 5 hours?
Yes, yeah.
Are you going to care about it in 5 days? Are you going to care about it in 5 months? Are you going to care in 5 years? And if you're not going to care in 5 years, then let's modulate our response.
Yeah,
Because
no,
if it
that when
really
you're
only
saying.
matters for the next 5 minutes, is this massive drama really what we want to spend our time and energy on?
Yeah.
And we kind of lose that thread, I think, when we get caught up in the doing of it all and we're forgetting to just be.
Yeah, and I part of it is in working with other people, just not as a professional, but as a human being interacting in a planet with other people, is the awareness is that even that what's really important to you today may be totally different than from what's important, but it doesn't mean it's not important to you. It's
No.
like it, right? So yeah, and everybody I know who's got enough life experience to have experienced some pretty hard stuff, they do have their own version of what you were talking about, which is like I'm no longer willing to be frustrated by the following things. Like I'm just not going to be pissed off about traffic. You know, I'm just not going to be annoyed at the line at the grocery store. And or it could go the other way. I'm not going to tolerate. You
Yes.
know, people doing treating me this way. Yeah, exactly. So one of the questions that pings around in my head when I talk to people about changes and things like this is whether it actually is truly possible to be ready for some of the crazy things that happen to us in life, you know, like and like so like I mean, this is a terrible question, but I'm gonna ask it anyway. Do you actually think where do you weigh in on this? Do you think that you could have been more prepared or well prepared for this to happen to you?
No.
Yeah, that's my end.
I think the way that we prepare is to be living in such a way that our foundation is strong and we know how to re-regulate our system when it gets dysregulated.
Yeah, or in or
Because that
sometimes just to
prepares
know that
us
it's
for
not
everything.
happening. Yeah,
Yeah.
that
Because
awareness that
could
I'm
I have
not regulated.
specifically prepared myself for the death of my son in these circumstances, in that complicated time in the world, in this timeline? No. Not any more than I had.
Yeah.
But I think how we prepare ourselves for life's ups and downs, whether they're big or little, is to really know what's important to us, right? Know what our moral compass says, what our values are,
Sure.
live according to those, and really have a sense of, you know, what's important and what's not important, and what's mine to own.
Yep.
That's been really important for me in this rebuilding process, is I got really clear. And I was already sort of on that path of exploring that and thinking about that and really looking at my relationships and my life. But I got really clear on having absolutely no desire to own anything that's not mine.
Right, which is, I mean, it's a recommended tool for being
Yeah.
happy.
But I think that's how we prepare, right? The
Yeah.
way that we prepare for life's worst moments is the same way we prepare for the best moments. Right? It's
Yeah.
knowing who we are, surrounding ourselves with good people, looking for the good in everything, being curious, being open, you know, being able to keep ourselves relatively calm, right? Understanding that sense of impermanence.
Yep.
That's
Yeah.
how we prepare, you
That's
know.
very good.
And I think understanding things helps, right? We're sense-making creatures. So if you can understand that grief is grief, even though, yes, the catastrophic loss of an adult child who still lived with you is different than your loss of a father. And it's still grief. And
It's
there's no
so.
win in that weird hierarchy we have of like, oh, well, it's a pet. Well, you should get
Yes.
another one to like,
Yeah.
I've lost a child. Like having summited that mountain, there's no win there. There's
There's no
like,
grief Olympics.
it's
There's
just not,
no
right?
trophy for having a worse story. Yes.
No.
Yeah.
And so, if we can level that a little bit while understanding that some will be more disruptive in our lives than others, but they're not even going to be the same for everyone. Because for some, the loss of a job or a business is wildly disruptive. And for some, they go, ah, I didn't really like it anyway, and they go get another one. So we can't, you know, when we label what's sort of worthy of grief or worthy of these big emotions, we're doing ourselves a big disservice. And most important, we're missing chances to practice because practicing grief skills on someone like me, a grieving mother grieving out loud, I am not a good first assignment.
Okay,
But,
fair
right? But
enough.
you might practice on like what you might want to say, how you might want to support someone. You could practice that on someone who's had a loss that feels less disruptive.
Yeah.
And it's all a chance to build connection instead of isolation. And right now, we're building isolation. because the griever feels alone, confused, misunderstood. They don't even understand themselves. The supporters don't know what to say or do. They don't want to do harm, so they end up doing nothing, which does harm. And now we're just all isolated, which isn't what anybody wanted or needed.
And I say right as an acknowledgement, not as a judgment, but as a just a word that I threw in there. All right, so you talk a lot about talking about grief and talking to people who are grieving. And so I did want to ask you if you wanted to share for us, based on your experience or your knowledge, however you want to go with this, what are some of the, because this is a topic that comes up, like this is what you say and this is what you should not say, and this is what you do and this is what you shouldn't do. And they're like, kind of almost like people feel like there are rules. We don't ever teach the rules, so people guess all the things, right? But what are some of the things that were really good that people said or did? And then if you want to share, what are some of the things that people said or did that were maybe like really kind of crappy or didn't feel good?
I would say that any cliche, platitudey kind of thing, if you could say it to anybody, don't say it. It's
Okay.
not going to be right because it's so unique and different each time. I actually think we have what we say and what we do backwards. We
Okay.
tend to say something really specific and shut down the conversation. And we tend to offer something really open, like anything you need, let me know.
Right.
Right? We have it backwards. We need to say something open, right? Open-hearted, probably a little bit vulnerable. It's going to be messy because we're really good at cliches and platitudes, which don't help anybody. So if we're trying something new, it's going to be messy. The most helpful things people said were things like, I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
And I don't really understand what's happening. And I'm here for you. And I will walk this walk with you and we will figure it out. I will get you tea or coffee. I will sit quietly if that's what you need. I will go to a smash room if that's what you need. I will do whatever you need. I'm here to support you. Right? Something like that. And you're not going to say that. And this is why I say, if I could come up with the one perfect thing, I'd
Sure.
be a billionaire. But there's never going to be, because what you would say to a close friend or a family member or a colleague or someone who's an acquaintance, for all the different kinds of loss, there's never going to be one right thing, which is why those cliches don't work. Right?
Fair enough. Yeah.
Place. They would want you to be happy. Aren't you over it yet? You should be moving on. All of those. Just make a list, have a ceremonial burning, however you need to release those back to wherever they came from. No more. They're actually actively harmful because the subtext of most of them is, I am not comfortable with your grief.
That's right. I don't want to. I'm going to say this and it ends the conversation and I'm
Yes.
not
And
will.
then can we
Yes.
talk
It
about something
feels
else?
very dismissive. Yeah. It's
It's
not what people
very.
mean, but it feels very dismissive.
Yeah. And the other thing, weirdly, that doesn't help is inserting your grief into the conversation.
Which I
So,
felt like I was doing earlier when I was adding my conversation about your dad, my dad into this. I was like, wait a
okay.
second. Like,
But I
I
want
do
to
feel
talk
like I
about
was
that
doing that.
because there's ways to do it that are really helpful and healthy, and there's ways to do it that aren't.
Yeah.
So, here's a perfect example. I was talking to someone recently about another loss that I had experienced, and they had phoned me to share their condolences and check up and see how I was doing. That conversation is supposed to be about me.
Yeah.
So when you add to that conversation, oh, this terrible thing happened at work and we're all really upset about it, you have dismissed what happened to me. Right? So
Yes.
that's not helpful. Or when you want to say, oh, yeah, well, I had a loss too. Okay, also not helpful. When you're having a conversation like you and I did, where you're saying, oh, yeah, I had this loss too. And that's so interesting. I also had this 12 to 18 months of like my brain just didn't work right. And we're having a conversation where we're learning from each other.
That's okay.
That's super helpful.
Because I think in my mind, it is me trying to make sense of where the questions go. And that was my intention. But as I was writing it and as I was doing it, I was like, I hope that I am not flipping this too. But it is hard to have a conversation with somebody about their experience without also jumping in and trying, and feeling like you're driving the ship. But
And I think some of that has to do with timeline, right? If it's
sure.
your earliest conversations with the person where really what you just want to be doing is supporting them and offering your love and offering space and giving them, holding them, that's not the time to be sharing your stories
Yeah.
about them,
One
right?
of the, you talked earlier about that you like to have, like, that it's helpful to have people bring up that they're thinking about them and
Ah,
doing stuff.
I love that.
One of the times where I was really struggling in my grief and trying to not show up in that grief. So it was a holiday, like a family holiday. So I was trying to be on my best behavior and not be a Debbie Downer.
Oh, I didn't care about that. That's one of the puzzle pieces I left behind.
And my father-in-law actually called me in on it. He noticed and he was like, I think you might be thinking about your dad today. And it was so helpful because I had pushed it so far down, trying to behave in such a way, which was a abject failure. I was in a terrible mood.
It's not
It
possible.
wasn't working, right? And when he brought it up, and then it forced me to actually think about it, and then the emotions flew through the emotions came out. She didn't actually make it a jolly holiday right off the bat, but I did feel better.
Well, and why do we have this expectation that it needs to be a jolly holiday?
Fair enough. I did
Right? Like
absolutely put a lot of pressure on myself for that. Yes.
yeah,
Yes.
to
Yeah.
pretend that nothing big had happened when there's like this big thing that happened. And
Yes,
likely had
exactly.
happened to everyone that's in on that jolly holiday. So how different could it have been if you had all said from the outset of planning the jolly holiday, we're all going to be thinking about dad that day. So how do we have him with us? How do we honor him? How do we have him at the table? How do we all share a funny story? Like, how do we acknowledge that and not have the event be only about that?
Yeah. No, I think that is beautiful, and I think it would be miraculous to go through this in a situation where you had a group of people, a community of people, whether it's your family or your friends, who did know how to do that and were able to do it. I mean, I did in my experience with walking the path of grief, I did find some people who had tools that they would walk me through it. They were supportive, which I did think was really helpful because it was like the great mystery of like, what am I doing? What am I doing and what's happening to me? Every time I found somebody who could say, oh, this is a process, I was like, whoa, pressure off. Let's try that.
You're supposed to be a hot mess
Yeah.
for a long time.
That did surprise me. And I can't imagine I do think it's very different. I think that's the reason it is an established trope and storytelling, the challenge of losing a parent, losing a child. Because a child losing a parent, that's the cycle of life. That's the way it's supposed to go. That's the story we're told, right? It's a club nobody wants to join, right? We don't prepare each other for it, but it is the way we're told it's supposed to go. But the other way, there's a lot of space there to internalize it and be like, something has gone wrong. I have done something wrong. The world is not working for me because things went out of order.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I never had that sense that I had done anything wrong. I was I didn't have that piece, though many people do, especially parents that experience the death of a child, because we're supposed to be able to take care of our children. That's our
Yeah.
job as parents, is literally to take care of them and make sure they live. And we failed at that one job. That's a whole made up story that isn't true, but
Yeah.
that's what we're told. But it is that sense of the world no longer makes sense.
Yeah.
Everything I was told about how the world operates was clearly a lie. And so
That's
now what?
yes. That you said that really beautifully, actually. That is such, it feels, it's like the Peppermint Patty, like when Charlie Brown falls out, it's like the rug is pulled out from underneath you. It's like everything that I was told about how this is supposed to work is not laying it out. And then you also hit on it. We're not going to talk about it today, but it is a very pervasive story that we tell parents that they are responsible for the behaviors and the actions of their children. They can control them, which is absolutely not true from day one, and an impossible standard for anybody to hold themselves to. But it's a real pressure that we put adults under. It's a real pressure. All right. So, as we record this in, we are recording this in April, but it's coming out much later. You have a TED Talk that has come out, which is, and I'll put the link to that and everything that goes out for the show. You say grief is hard. Let's do better. Why do you feel that it is helpful and important that we do better with grief?
Because it's the one guaranteed thing we're going to experience.
Oh,
It's guaranteed.
interesting.
Everybody's going to experience it. Everyone's going to need support to support someone through it. And right now, we are terrible.
Fair
And that
enough.
is doing harm. It's doing harm to our communities. It's doing harm to our families. It's doing harm to our friendships. It's doing harm. And we can do better. We
We
can do
can do
better.
better. We can do better. All right. So, in a minute, we're going to do the final questions. I want to give you a chance to directly speak to the audience and tell them about what you do and how they can connect with you.
Yeah, thank you. I love that. So the best way to connect with me is on LinkedIn or Facebook or on my website. All of them are Suzanne Jabbour. So if you can figure out how to spell my complicated name, you will find me everywhere. I'm grateful to have a complicated name. I'm the only one. What I'm really excited about is a new-ish way that I'm offering my services to the public, which is taking sort of the best of what I do with private clients and with organizations and offering it in a drop-in workshop structure. So at this point, well, we're in April. Where they'll be in June, I'm not sure, but you can pull up my calendar. There's six different workshops right now, but I'm always adding to them as people request things. So there's three that are for grievers. One is about anticipatory grief, one's about collective grief, and one is a small group for people with specific losses to them, personal losses. So that's what's up for grievers. And then for people trying to support someone or to just understand grief better, there's three for them. So those are what can I say, what can I do, and what about at work?
Oh,
So
very
those
nice.
run on a drop-in basis. Each month, a new schedule comes out because I just keep kind of moving them around till I figure out where the sweet spots are for people. And there, I have made them very inexpensive because I don't want there to be a financial barrier for people. And for your wonderful listeners, I'm happy to offer a discount code, which
Yes.
will be in the show notes, and you can use that to get 10% off.
Yes, exactly. So the code is going to be the letters AIA.
Yes.
And it's 10% off. That is a very generous offer on a very important product. I hope that people will take advantage of it and tell their friends of places, because it is a time when we tend to feel alone, and just having anybody to offer us the slightest illumination of a path forward is, I think, very helpful. So for everybody watching that heard all of those things, all of those links go in the show notes. So if you're listening, they're there. But the easiest way to get all those links is to be a subscriber to the Perfect Adulting email community, and then they come right into your email box and you just click on them. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy. So, Suzanne, are you ready for the final three questions, the rapid fire questions?
I am. Let's go.
Let's do it. All right. Do you know the quote from Eleanor Roosevelt that says, "Do something every day that scares you"? Yeah. Okay. So,
Yes.
what is something that scares you?
Oh my gosh. There is actually not much that scares me. I think when your whole world has fallen apart, you get less scared. I am still a little bit scared of like extreme height related adventury things. So one of the things I want to do is like skydive.
Okay.
And I know I'll be terrified and I'm going to do it anyways, but that's something that kind of scares me.
No, I get that. I do get that. I've just have recently been like, oh, maybe I'll do it. But it's always been a thing that I'm like, I don't think that I'll like it. I have bungee jumped, which is why I don't think I'd like skydiving. But yeah, no, I do get that. I will push it though. Like if I go to Australia, when I go to Australia, I'm absolutely going to climb over the bridge, which is high up over water, which is the thing. But I mean, it's worth doing. Like it's worth pushing through. All right. So today in our modern world, they're trying to figure out how to send human beings to Mars. This is not something that I myself am working on, but by the way, I'm working on it. If you were offered a spot on a spaceship going to Mars, if they called you up like, "Suzanne, we've got a seat for you," do you say yes or no?
No.
I don't know why I love this question so much. I was writing it totally cracking myself up. I think it's such a
Have no
ridiculous
interest.
question.
Let's figure out how to take care of the one planet we have. We don't need to go mess up another one. When we figured out how to take care of this one, then maybe we deserve another
That's fair. That's totally fair. All right, last one, much easier. Do you like tea, coffee, both, or neither?
Oh, both.
There you go. Suzanne Jabbour, thank you for being a wonderful guest today on The Art of Imperfect Adulting.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself. Head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.